You know, I've been saying for some time that the story for me around reporting around the COVID has been the work of independent data analysts. And we've been so blessed to talk, for instance, with Dr. Andrew Bostom, who's been tracking the absolute fraud of the Atlantic COVID tracking project and their lies about the deaths in Florida. Legitimate lies at this point. They know they're doing that. We've talked with my friend Justin Hart, independent data analyst, Kyle Lamb, who calculated some of the deaths that are happening because of the lockdown. I am so excited to welcome who I think is the star of this particular field. Gentlemen, we're going to call Ethical Skeptic. He's Ethical Skeptic on Twitter. Ethical, welcome to the Todd Herman Show.
Hey, Todd. It's a pleasure to be on the Todd Herman Show.
Thank you so much. And I know this is, I believe this is your first radio interview as Ethical Skeptic. And you were kind enough to share with me who you are. So I can definitely see why you can do what you can do, which is phenomenal data analysts. So tell people a little bit about your background, then we'll get into your work and what you have been telling the people about the COVID.
Well, my background is systems engineering, and really in that regard, the top school in the world. Moved from that into naval intelligence, several theaters that I went through that I, you know, don't want to talk about right now. But from naval intelligence, went in to start my own strategy and operations company and grew that to really be one of the top advisory companies in the world. Over 200 corporate clients and probably about 15 to 18 nations doing infrastructure and operations strategy, rollout planning, mergers, consolidations, development, all those critical aspects of what those entities do.
And so you're a systems thinker. You are very meticulous in how you view problems and unwind those, as what I see. And I started following you with your analysis of COVID. I want to ask real quick before we get into, for instance, this 6% number that the media doesn't understand why people like us are interested in that 6%. They think that we think it means that the virus doesn't exist or something. We'll talk about that. But what drew your attention to COVID-19 as someone who analyzes data and systems?
Well, initially, you know, certainly the reports coming out of China were alarming, and justifiably so. The data continues, you know, to look dire coming out of all the world statistics. So early on, it was a great concern for me because of my background and exposure in the medical and pharmaceutical industry, doing strategy in that industry over the decades. I was called in to do a minor part of the COVID response with a particular client. And from there, I was able to, you know, gain proprietary data, in particular data, detailed data behind the scenes of COVID, and added hopefully a lot of value in the COVID response effort. But I was also able to use a lot of that data, the non-proprietary portion, to begin to develop and lens perspectives around the COVID issue. And my perspective on it did change a little bit across the months of analysis here. And you could see that, you know, my timeline on Twitter or on the ethicalskeptic.com website, you can see the progression in my change of sentiment on the issue. Yeah.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of very interesting nuggets of information that you brought us. One of them is sort of an Uber analysis that I consider to be the most important chart I've ever seen. And this has to do in North America with the reality of the decrease in COVID deaths compared to this period of time where we heard from, I think, almost nearly unanimous in the media, we heard cases, cases, cases. And you display this so beautifully, and you've said some fairly serious things about this in regard to liability lawsuits, etc. So I wanted to start there, which is this comparison to the decrease in deaths that seems that maps the way this virus works, the normal cycle, with this self-repeating, self-replicating sort of panic cycle that happens in the majority of the media. So can we talk through that?
Absolutely. I think this was one of the key elements that I analyzed that began to change my sentiment a little bit. And I want to make it clear, this is still a very dangerous virus. It's more severe than the flu. It's just asymmetric. In other words, its damage is done on a different end of the age tier spectrum than the flu. So for those under 60 years old, it's less dangerous than the flu. But for those over 80 years old, it's more dangerous than the flu. So that asymmetry, if you will, has caused us a lot of difficulty in discussing this issue in media sound bites. It's not that simple. But what I developed is a thing called the lemming cycle of continuous impairment. And it's somewhat of a humorous title, not to make light of this issue itself. But it's both a parody and a satire. The parody is of a thing called the dimming cycle of continuous improvement, something that I'm familiar and worked with in my past. And it's developed by Dr. William Edwards Deming, and it's just a way of reducing costs and improving customer service and market delivery for a corporation or any operating entity. This is a parody of that, in that I call it the lemming cycle of continuous impairment, but it's also the allegorical lemmings who run off a cliff as well. But it's also a satire of this condition wherein we use the rate of testing to falsely instill panic in our general population and our second tier levels of government. In other words, early on, we didn't have enough test kits to determine what was the arrival rate of the pandemic. In other words, how fast was it growing? So we issued federal money, federal emergency money. We bought test kits and we deployed them to the field, all ethical things to do. And then when we saw the rate of cases that existed, we panicked. And we saw the curve of increase, that what everybody called exponential increase, we panicked. So we demanded more testing. And that, in turn, showed that we had more cases. And then when we saw those increased cases, we panicked again and asked for more testing, then track and trace. And this cycle became like a lemming rush off a cliff. It was a lemming cycle that fed itself. It was a downward spiral. That's why I called it continuous impairment in that little satirical comment. Yeah.
Yeah, and so ethical skeptics with us, and that dynamic, ethical, that is what I think empowered the lockdown to persist, wasn't it? Because I heard cases, and look, compared to you, I'm a monkey. I mean, I can synthesize data and read it, and I've spent some time in high tech, but not naval intelligence. I'm not a systems thinker. But I could look at some things and say, wait a minute, cases doesn't mean anything. Well, cases, that doesn't mean anything. If I get a case and I'm very healthy at 50, that doesn't matter. Statistically, I'm not going to die from this. And it doesn't matter unless you're in these age groups we're talking about. So I get very frustrated with the predominant media coverage saying cases, cases, cases. And I wanted to say, but with who? Wait, how are the cases resolving? Are any of these cases where people had had T-cell immunity? And now we know that there's T-cell immunity, et cetera. Do you think that that cycle of cases, more testing? Wait, there's more cases. We need more testing. Do you think that that is what allowed the lockdown to persist as long as it did?
I think so. I think there were probably two species of mistake. Number one, we really didn't know what we should have known about coronaviruses going into this. And you could say, well, okay, we didn't have a great precedent set. You know, the last comparable coronavirus was in 2003, SARS-CoV coronavirus 1. There's some explanation there, but we really didn't have a grasp of the latitudinal effect, that there would be a latitude surge at the end of this under a Hope Simpson effect. We really didn't look at this from the perspective of Farr's law, that this was going to be not a bell curve, but a somewhat lopsided bell curve, a quick increase and then a quick drop off. For some reason, we forgot all that epidemiological expertise and decided that this virus early on was some magical monster that was going to destroy us. And that was the first critique I had. We overreacted somewhat in the early stages of this as a result of that type of thinking. But then when we began to learn what was happening, when we saw the lemming cycle of panic and the feedback cycle of how testing was driving panic, we didn't take that lesson and then turn it into smarter actions. We continued, we doubled down on the lockdown. And the net result of those two species of error, the early misinterpretation of what this was and then the misinterpretation of the case increases, we used that to conduct a bad panic reaction, which is now bearing the potential to harm people greater than COVID itself did.
And I want to get to that because this is a phenomenally important piece of data and work that you've done. And Ethical Skeptic is with us on Twitter. He is at Ethical Skeptic, ethicalskeptic.com. I've been talking about this for some time because there's been physicians, ethical. There's been, you know, some 600 physicians called the lockdown a mass casualty event. I've been, you know, talking with people in the adolescent mental health care world saying, hey, we're seeing an increase in suicides. And now I see, I had to talk on my show this morning about the fact that there are record high levels of male suicides in ages that generally don't lend themselves to these big spikes. You did an analysis, and I so admire that you source your data. I've observed you talking with other data analysts about your data and their data. It's like a casual sort of peer review, which I think is fascinating. And I think that this is also the story of reporting on the COVID. You've looked at deaths of misery and lack of access to healthcare and compared this to death from COVID-19. And you came up with some numbers I want everybody to understand. You said both are tragic, but one was manslaughter on top of tragic. Unreported COVID deaths grew to a 3.2-week backlog. 9 weeks of legacy death reporting will last through October 30. This is an older tweet of yours, August 28th. I guess it's not that old. But you're calculating 0.95 million years life lost to COVID-19, 1.44 million life years lost to the overreaction. Break that down for us, and that's everything I sense, Ethical, but let's break down the numbers so people understand it.
Yes, a good portion of this comes from the MMWR database at the National Center for Health Statistics, NCHS, so then the CDC itself, but they're somewhat linked at the hip there. But yes, what I'm estimating is that we've had about 200, as of August 15th, we've had about 245,000 excess deaths. Not all those are COVID deaths. The majority are COVID deaths. However, 57,600 of those deaths are deaths from the actual panic and lockdown itself. I hate to use the word lockdown because it implies that we're equivalent to every other country that locked down. That's not the case. But let's use the term lockdown here. We had really two types. Deaths that have ended so far, they were cardiac and diabetes deaths where individuals could not get access to acute care services, Alzheimer's deaths, which continue to be above the five-year average because of lack of access or abandonment, those types of issues, stroke access, lack of access to acute services, strokes increased, flu and pneumonia deaths increased. All that, for the most part, has ended since people are able to get back quickly to their critical health care resources. However, there are categories of fatalities in the U.S. that are still growing. Cancer, our most recent MMWR database review showed that what are called malignant myoplasms are growing at a significant rate now. These are people who couldn't get in to get cancer diagnoses. And this is a large number of people. This falls under a thing called the law of large numbers. COVID is an effect that happens to a small population, even though it sounds large to us. But cancer is an effect that happens to a very large population. So a very minor change in the landscape of cancer can result in a very large set of deaths at a later time. And indeed, that's what we're seeing occurring here, is that malignant myoplasm deaths are on the increase. In fact, it's increasing as of August 15th faster than I've even projected in this number that I just read you, the 57,600 COVID deaths. In addition to that, a more darkened or dismal side of this increase of deaths is what I call suicide addiction, abandonment, and abuse. These are deaths of despair. These are deaths for people who are at risk under substance abuse or under depression or types of mental illness, or people that have lost their livelihood. And that's what really concerns me, the number of businesses that are operating below their break-even level and are having to shut down, reduce operations, lay people off. Really, one-third of the people I know right now who were formerly employed are now unemployed because of COVID. And they won't lose their house during the COVID window. They're going to lose their homes 2 and 3 months from now. Those are the people I'm concerned about. That group of people falls under the law of large numbers. There are going to be dramatically more deaths that arise over the next 3 to 4 years from this SAANA, suicide, addiction, abandonment, and abuse, than all of the COVID deaths. But there's a second aspect to it, and you mentioned it. The people who die in these death categories are on average age 40, 50, 45, 36, 22. They have a greater number of life years remaining to their livelihood. Comparatively, the preponderance of COVID deaths on average, I'm estimating, have about 5 to 6 years remaining life. And that's tragic as well, certainly. But if we multiply the number of people who've passed on under the COVID response versus those who passed on from COVID by the years they had remaining in life, the stark reality is that the COVID reaction response has caused much more misery and death than has COVID, the virus itself.
I think we sense these things. You know, ethical skeptics with us, Twitter data analysts, and we gave his bio at the top of the show here, and I've confirmed his identity. And I think we sense this, and it makes it very frustrating because my show's airs in Washington State. We have listeners, courtesy of Rush Limbaugh. We have listeners all across the country, so everybody's dealing with this in one way or another. But there are these states that persist in lockdown or in some form of lockdown. California, Oregon, Washington. The governor of Oregon has said she's extending it through Election Day, which is interesting. Then there was this week this happened on social media, but it's not necessarily a new number. The CDC updated their numbers to show that 6% of people died just from COVID-19. That was what killed them. There were no other factors to that. And that left 94% of people who died with COVID. You did an analysis, as I understand it, of the big 14 comorbidities. You drew this from databases. Let's talk about this because the 6% is big news. And I've seen media people say, oh, this is conservatives trying to pretend that the virus isn't taking lives. And no, that's not at all what we're saying. What I'm saying is, no, I've seen a predominant media that has refused to say what you said, ethical, which is for people of advanced age, you should be very mindful and maybe even very careful around this virus. Those of us that are younger, we're far more likely to die of the flu. So you did That's this correct. Analysis of the 14 comorbidities. Then you broke this out into COVID deaths died because we panicked and would have died later. So let's talk about that as we wrap up.
Sure. This comes from the National Center on Health Statistics, the MMWR database that I previously mentioned. They maintain deaths by state, by week, by 14 major categories. So I scraped that data from their website and put that into a pivot structure, a pivot table, and analyzed it and deduced. And that means to simply eliminate or falsify until you get the one answer which remains, somewhat akin to the quip attributed to Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes. But deduction is that process which is definitive if you're able to eliminate every other possibility. You're left with the remaining possibility, especially with regard to math, because math is a closed set, you do end up with the remaining answer. And this is what I found, is that though it's not 6%. The 6% is somewhat a red herring, a distraction. They're shooting down the 6% as a conspiracy theory when the number is wrong, but the principle is still correct. And we've got to see through that smokescreen. Those who passed on out of the MMWR database, the NCHS database, those who passed on from COVID alone are 19% of the excess deaths that we've experienced since March 28th this year. 19% are just COVID. You look on the death certificate and the U.701 categorization, primary cause of death is COVID, and there's nothing in the follow-on columns. That's 19%. Now, there's a thing called underlying conditions. Most people have underlying conditions. So if you're going to die, you're probably going to have a primary cause of death and underlying conditions. So this should be common. 27% of the total excess fatalities that the CDC has reported in their database are a primary cause of death by COVID, but also had underlying conditions. So most commonly, the average age of this death category is going to be 83, 86. Now, that's a guess on my part looking at the, you know, the curves, but it's going to be pretty close. So that's underlying conditions. Then there's a next category where COVID is secondary or tertiary on the death certificate. And that's a different condition there. 23% of all the excess deaths were a situation where the individual died of a primary cause, but COVID was secondary. The danger we have here is a thing called a nosocomial death. In other words, you're coming to the hospital because you had a heart attack. You're at risk of dying from that heart attack. And then you contract COVID because you're in the RNA footprint of COVID at the hospital during that window of you know, the high preponderance of the virus being around. That's the group of deaths that concerns me the most, where COVID is secondary or tertiary. That's 23%. We do have a category of excess deaths which are unreported or not yet known, and I want to keep that for conservancy isolated out unto itself. That's 11%. We're still tapping into that with daily state reports, or what I call legacy death laundering, if you will. When you report a death as a state 6 weeks late, you're instilling panic in the population. You need to be clear and transparent on that data. That's still about 11% of total deaths. But the final important category are those deaths that originated from the panic response itself. That's 20% right now of all excess deaths that we've experienced this year actually were generated by our miscall politically and our bad actions in terms of social response to the COVID virus.
Yeah, and the way you break this out on your tweet, Ethical Skeptics, with us, Novod COVID deaths, 45,223. People would have died later in the year, 118,773. Died because we panicked, 47,415. We've gone a little long. I want to ask if you can stick around with us, Ethical Skeptics.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you to do some analysis that's not numerical. This is going to take some supposition. Ethical Skeptics with us on the Todd Herman Show on AM 770 KTTH. Hey, welcome back. We're still with the Ethical Skeptic, at Ethical Skeptic on Twitter, ethicalskeptic.com. We've been through the numbers. I want to get one bit of analysis from you that's not numerical. And this is where I have a real challenge, Ethical Skeptic, is we talked about the deaths from panic. We talked about the overreaction. I have a real hard time when I know that Tony Fauci's team had two people on his team who wrote a paper saying lockdowns don't work. Do not lock down in the case of a respiratory SARS type respiratory virus. It's counterproductive. That was a published work that I have to believe the CDC was aware of. Their doctors helped write it. We had the World Health Organization who had that point of view. They had points of view that contact tracing, after there's this, you know, in an urban area, you get past 50 people, contact tracing is a useless exercise. Dr. Scott Atlas has said the same thing and said that on my program in March. I see suddenly that they are, their studies, their data, their, you know, controlled randomized trials, I think 12 to 15 of them have said masks do not prohibit the flow or the transmission of SARS type respiratory viruses, but they're demanding that people wear masks. It's almost like all the learning, all the knowledge from the Spanish flu that, you know, the face coverings didn't work. They were universally held, universally. You could be shot, put in jail if you didn't wear them. It's almost like when this virus landed, the body of knowledge, the amassed learnings was just erased. And this takes some supposition on your part unless you have some data on this. But I look at this and I am left wondering, how in the world did they just forget everything or just ignore what they knew?
Well, I think a lot of it was intimidation from the data coming out of China and the World Health Organization early on. I mean, I was fully on board with that. I'm still on board that this is an exceptionally dangerous virus. That's clear in the data. But what we've done may become more dangerous than the virus itself. That's my central thesis right now. But early on, the intimidation factor, both from the virus and the news coming out of the WHO and China, I think it put us in a little bit of a social fight or flight syndrome, where we dropped our knowledge about latitudinal effects. We dropped our knowledge that coronaviruses are sharply seasonal, and there are scientific studies which prove that out. We dropped our knowledge about Farr's Law. We lost our resident knowledge. We lost our mind over the panic ensuing around this virus. And early on, I think the thirst for federal emergency money played a little bit into that, but I'm not sure that that was an incorrect thing to do. We did need to allocate federal emergency funds to get testing rolled out and respond to the virus. But I think that it became an opportunity for political extremists to then exploit the condition. And in order to exploit the condition and harm their political enemies, those who operate medium to small businesses, they had to somewhat continue this forgetting of Farr's Law, to continue this forgetting of Hope Simpson, to continue this forgetting of key epidemiological truths, and to squelch those things so that we could continue to harm political opponents. And this is what I call a human rights crime, because you do not spread misinformation to a population under duress in order to remove their sovereignty or the government's reporting to them. In other words, our government reports to our citizen base. You don't do that. And in doing 16 or 18 national strategies, it becomes clear to me that there are certain ethical actions that you do to favor and benefit the population of a nation. There are certain unethical actions you can do, which hunters do and warlords do. We did those things here. We fed misinformation to a people at risk. And that is one of the deepest, one of the darkest human rights crimes that can be committed. It doesn't mean the virus is not deadly, but what we did in the reaction became an artifice of political extremists, and those political extremists need to be held accountable. Their universities need to be held accountable. The foundations which fund those universities with offshore trading accounts, those need to be held accountable. And we need class action and oppression, harking back to the Monsanto precedent here of oppression. We need those lawsuits filed, because significant damage has been done, and it's going to manifest over the next 3-4 years.
That's just beautifully said. It's frightening. And this has been the sense that one of the things I know, ethical skeptic, is I know politics. I know communication. I know selling and marketing and positioning and developing a market and creating a market and using wedge issues. And when I watched the predominant media go from 3 million will die, I was like you. I was telling my wife, we don't have any immune system. We have no immunity to this. This is nuts. I mean, yeah, we're going to lock down. We're going to, be careful. Very quickly, when I saw a picking of winners and losers so a Planned Parenthood clinic, that's fine. But a dentist's office, that's not fine. I said, no, none of this is science. That was what got my suspicions up. But when I watched the major media go from deaths, they took a break during the riots and then started to scream about cases without context. That's where my antenna went up, because you've said this is a very dangerous virus. It's uniquely dangerous. And then you say ellipses for this population. And I've seen multiple attempts made by the government to say that children are going to die from this. They're still doing this. In the state of Washington, they're still merchandising the idea that COVID stalks minority kids. They're still merchandising. That's a quote, stalks them. So that's where I got frustrated. So it's interesting to hear someone with a far different skill set, far smarter than me in systems thinking, come to that same conclusion. So I want to thank you for joining us on the Todd Hermes Show. It's just a real honor to have you on. And I want you to know that you and Justin Hart and Kyle Lamb, and you guys are the story on this. And I think that your analysis on this has been so key, so helpful. I just think it's heroic. And I appreciate you coming on the Todd Hermes Show. I think it's your first radio interview, isn't it?
It is on this, and as ethical skeptic, I think I've had a couple of podcasts, but really first significant radio interview. Absolutely.
All right. Well, then I am very proud of that. Ethical skeptic, thanks for joining us on the Todd Hermes Show. Keep up the great work. We need you.
Thank you, Todd. Appreciate it.
Thank you. That's why we are so lucky on this radio show to be able to speak truth outside of the realms of the predominant media with people like Ethical, Andrew Boston. I want to wrap this up with some thoughts that came in on Twitter as we were talking Ethical Skeptic. It's the Todd Herman Show.